Okay, oh yes, thank you. As promised, I gave you this condensed outline, and I hope you'll take a look at it over the holiday to get ready for Monday when I. Oh, sorry. Did everybody get a copy of this? There should be some extras floating around, maybe. And I'll post one online as well if you want to download it. And again, the purpose of this is not so much to tell you in Johnny Carson fashion everything you ever wanted to know about tort law, but rather in a kind of summary form here to at least name the things that I'm hoping you have learned as we've marched through these first three chapters. And on Monday, I invite you to ask me questions where, for example, you are puzzled that something's left out of the outline that you have a lot of detail on, or in particular where things are said differently in the outline from what you have, that there are three elements for something when you had four or vice versa, that I use a phrase that, and you have a different place for it. Obviously, I'm not, well, it's not obvious that I'm not interested in, but I want to tell you that I am not interested in particular phrases. It happens that as I read exams, I come across phrases that I recognize as coming from the outline, and that isn't what I'm looking for. I'm also not looking for originality. One of the things you learn is that in law school is that unlike, say, graduate school or other kinds of places where there's a premium on being creative and original, in law there's there's no shame, and in fact, there's quite a bit of glory in simply parroting something that has come from an accepted authority, quoting a statute or quoting a line from a case and so forth. But again, my purpose here is not to say that these phrases are magical or what have you, but rather to show you, in effect, that it can be done to take what we have learned and express it in a relatively compact way, and that to the extent that your notes are far more extensive, far more detailed, they should be, in effect, organized in a way that allows you to be able to summarize them in the same kind of compact form. When you read this, you will find, well, gee, I would have said that a little bit differently, or I have said that a little bit differently, and you want to be sure that the differences are stylistic rather than substantive. So, you say potato, I say potato. That's just a stylistic difference. But you say potato, I say tomato. Sounds the same, close, but those are different vegetables. So as you look through your notes and you say, well, gee, he said it this way and I said it that way, there are times when I hope you can, well, gee, that's just a difference in style, but you may want to reassure yourself that these two things mean the same thing. When I say this, that's the equivalent of what you've said there, right? And in particular, as you discuss amongst yourselves, if you have other people that you study with or that you kind of use as a feedback mechanism, again, then you get to sort of compare and say, yeah, we're all on the same page. So again, that's the agenda for Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, for that matter. Additionally, as I said before, if you start looking at prior exams, and as you formulate your own answer to those past exams and you compare them to the sample answer, and in a similar way you say, well, gee, I came to a different conclusion. I'd like to know whether I was crazy to be talking about this, or why is it you didn't talk about that, or why is it you went on for pages about this when I thought that was a kind of a non-issue. So again, any clarification that I can offer you next week is what I want to do, so that we are on the same page come December. Any other preliminary questions or issues before we finish off Chapter 3 here? Okay, well, let's... I think we're in the middle of Schoenberger versus Roberts. Mr. Viviano was summarizing for us the state of the law prior to Schoenberger, namely under the common law or the reasoning that the courts had used prior to this statute. The reasoning was that evidence about collateral sources should be excluded because, in fact, lots of times, though the plaintiff had already received compensation from some other source, it was the kind of compensation that had to be repaid, like insurance proceeds or workers' comp benefits or the like, so that when the defendant paid these to the plaintiff, it wasn't like the plaintiff was getting a windfall. The plaintiff would have to redirect that money back to its original source. Moreover, even if there were a windfall in some cases and the plaintiff got compensated by the defendant as well as compensation from an insurance fund or a generous relative or some other source, it seemed to the courts that it was more equitable that the plaintiff benefit from that windfall than to allow the defendant, under the guise of avoiding double dipping, to pay or to in effect become the beneficiary of the workers' comp program or the generosity of a relative or the like. Okay, so that's the state of the common law. Now the statute. What did the statute do to affect that state of affairs? Actually, that wasn't a common law rule, but it's either a provision of contract law, that is, I purchase insurance, the insurance company agrees to provide me with certain kinds of benefits, but they condition it on the obligation to reimburse them. So that's a contractual obligation. Or there may be a separate statute in giving me workers' comp benefits. Workers' comp also says, by the way, we expect to be reimbursed. Okay? Okay. Okay, so part of what we're concerned about here is the risk of jury misunderstanding. The jury would assume that you're telling me about these workers' comp benefits because I'm supposed to take them into account in arriving at the award. And everybody agrees they shouldn't do that. That the jury is supposed to hear about, or if the jury hears about the workers' comp benefit, they should nonetheless grant the plaintiff a full award so that the plaintiff may then repay workers' comp. But it's very plausible to assume that at least in some cases the jurors would misunderstand. We could cure that, of course, by having a, 80-point type instruction to the jury, please do not, reduce the amount of your award based upon the workers' comp benefit. You're being told about that, but it's not supposed to be. If that's our primary concern, we can deal with that, I suppose, by a more emphatic instruction on that point. But there's another concern here, I guess. Or what did the trial judge do with that? Let's first get to the bottom line. Defendant offers evidence, or doesn't yet offer the evidence, but in a sense tells the judge, makes an offer of proof, or otherwise announces the intention to offer this evidence, and the plaintiff objects. And what does the trial judge do? Okay, rules it inadmissible. And does the trial judge give any explanation for that? Okay, so one of the basic purposes of evidence, and you'll talk more about this when you take the course on evidence, but one of the basic principles in ruling on offered testimony or documents is relevance. That in effect you need this information or this evidence is useful in arriving at the decision that the jury is going to have to make. To what purpose would such evidence be admissible? The defendant says, I want the jury to hear this evidence, and the trial judge would say, in effect, why? What are they supposed to do with this? That's what the plaintiff says. Does the defendant have an alternative scenario? Can anybody think of a reason why the jury would benefit from knowing about this? Yeah. You mean would the plaintiff be underpaid? Okay, but we're now flipping it around, so we're asking whether the defendant has some good reason, you know. What is the purpose of admitting this evidence? Why does the jury need to... Okay, obviously the issue is which... There's a very different measure of damages, or they call it workers' compensation, and it's wage loss and medical expense. When the plaintiff's lawyer asks the jury to make an award of compensatory damages, we're talking about pain and suffering, future wage loss, you know, we get our economists to do all this stuff, it's a much bigger number compared to what workers' comp is talking about. And the defendant obviously would like to have the jury think that something they call workers' compensation is real compensation. That's the kind of number you should be thinking about. $16,000-$18,000, not $125,000. Yeah, let's recalibrate your idea of compensation. There's another reason why the defendant would very much like to have this evidence in front of the jury, even if there's a jury instruction in 80-point type that makes it impossible that the jury would ever miscalculate it. They'll be out on the street rattling their tin cup. To the extent, obviously, that a part of what motivates a jury to look carefully at the issues of liability would be the sense, gee, if we don't award this person compensation, they're going to be stuck paying for medical expenses and time missed from work, and they'll have nowhere else to go. Once the jury is told, oh, by the way, don't feel too sorry for this person, he's already recovered workers' comp, then the jury may say, well, fine, you prove your liability case, plaintiff, and we'll be happy to find for you, but we're not going to make an award just out of sympathy. So these two attractive aspects of this evidence, number one, that it reduces the kind of sympathy factor. It allows us to look at the liability question more or less straight up or down. That's good for the defendant. And secondly, that it makes the plaintiff's idea of compensation look exaggerated compared to what, well, yeah, sure, it's a state bureaucracy, and we know they're probably on the stingy side, but I like the kind of numbers they're talking about. So the defendant believes that there is a purpose to this. At least there's certainly a strategic value, but did the legislature have that in mind? Did the legislature know that this evidence was potentially confusing, but wanted it to go in anyway because the collateral benefit, so to speak, would be desirable, or was the legislature not quite thinking? They didn't connect the dots here and left a bunch of stuff on the table that was never supposed to turn out the way it actually did. What does the majority of the appellate court say? Yeah. We have great respect for the legislature, don't get us wrong, but I don't think they had their thinking caps on that day. And to do what they literally have asked us to do would be to produce this absurdity. The dissent, however, says, right. We're just judges. We're supposed to shut up and do what we're told. It's not for us to judge the wisdom of the legislature's command here. The command is unmistakable. It says this evidence is admissible. Who is the trial judge? Who are we to say, no, that's a dumb idea? Now, again, it raises these questions about what judges are supposed to do in cases like this. I doubt that any of us cares a whole heck of a lot about, it's kind of fun watching all the snow fall off the roof there. None of us cares a whole heck of a lot about how you calculate the offset for workers' comp damages. But we do care a lot about other kinds of issues where judges are trying to interpret something, whether it's a statute or whether it's a constitution, where we have to make a choice between either saying, it is not our job to make sense of this, it's our job to shut up and do what we're told, versus those who say, it is for the courts to kind of connect the dots and make the whole thing work out in a sensible sort of way. And obviously, I think one of the temptations for a court is to kind of abstract from the initial command to a larger sense of generality. So I think of what, you know, my teenagers might do if I give them instructions when I leave for the evening. Well, you can have your friends over, but please stay out of the liquor cabinet. And my children say to themselves, well, yes, that was his command. But let's think about this for a moment. the purpose of the command was to provide for our safety, right? Now, what would happen if a burglar, somebody came to the door with a gun and said, I need a drink fast, get me a drink or I'll blow your head off? Would my parents say, no, what I said, I have said? No, they would say, I go to the liquor cabinet, I get this guy a drink, right? That's what they'd want me to do. Well, I've got a little different situation. My friends are here. They want a drink. I'm not exactly in physical danger, but their command was never absolute. You know, obviously you can see the capacity to rationalize, but by the same token, it does call into question. Well, as a matter of fact, I wasn't absolute in saying, don't get into the liquor cabinet. I did not mean that absolutely. But where you draw the line between a sort of stupid literalness and, on the other hand, a sort of willful rationalization of what I want to do, you know, that's a very tough line to draw. And again, in this case, you may be more inclined to agree with the majority who says, let's make sense of this. Let's try to fulfill what we think are the legislature's true purposes here. Or you may be more sympathetic with the dissent, who is worried that the majority is simply doing what they would prefer, and the dissent wants to draw a stricter line here. But again, it's a classic problem the judges face. How do you find the right balance between an inappropriate literalism and, on the other hand, the ability to take something and sort of rationalize it through this clever reasoning process to the point where you've evaded something that you're supposed to be doing? Yeah. Well, sometimes floor debates are revealing, and sometimes they're equivocal. As it happens, I've been quoted on the floor of the United States Senate. Rick Santorum was introducing an amendment on the No Child Left Behind Act, and he introduced what was later called the Santorum Amendment, which we've pressed. It's part of my anti-Darwinian campaign. I'm crazy in lots of respects, that being one of them. But in any event, there was an amendment. It then got put into a conference report. Senator Kennedy and Senator Clinton both endorsed this amendment at the time it was offered, which immediately put me into a panic. But they later came to their senses and changed their minds, you know, and said, no, this is a bad idea. So, again, what people say in the floor debates, what comes out later on in the struggle over the final language of the bill, the language was actually taken out of the bill, it was put into the conference report, and there's still a huge fight about whether the Santorum Amendment is binding law. Some people say it was taken out of the bill. Some people say, it was put in the conference report. The meaning of the legislation is never, floor debates only launch you into more controversy about, well, was this person speaking for the body when they made these comments or not? So, again, sorry for that little digression there. But again, the problem, I think, the larger problem in terms of being a judge faced with a piece of legislation or a constitutional provision whose intent is lost in the mist of time, you have to do what you can to make a fair reading to fulfill the intent of the people who wrote it. oftentimes guessing at what that intent was. Okay, well, let's. If there are any other questions, again, what I want you to pull away from this is that the collateral source rule helps plaintiffs, works to the defendant's disadvantage. It also the reality of it, just in, so that you know, for purposes of evaluating cases, that the necessity of paying back these collateral sources, like workers' comp, can very much affect the ability to settle a case. Let's suppose the defendant is willing to pay $100,000 to settle a claim, but there's a $60,000 lien that has to be paid to workers' comp. Well, that takes all the fun out of it. From the plaintiff's standpoint, settling this case for $100,000 doesn't put any what is called new money into the plaintiff's pocket. It just pays off the lawyers. So in order to settle the case, the defendant has to offer enough money to cover not only the workers' comp lien, not only get the lawyer paid, but leave something that will actually benefit the plaintiff. So again, these lots of cases involve either some sort of insurance payment or workers' comp or other sorts of collateral sources that muddy up the picture. Okay, the last thing I wanted to cover today was Botta versus Brunner on page 116 and the final case of Jewett versus Deutsch. The issue in both cases is how far we will let plaintiff's lawyers enhance their arguments in order to extract the highest verdict from the plaintiff. And at least with respect to the so-called per diem argument, the question is whether this is a really an acceptable, accurate representation of the plaintiff's situation, or whether it's a fundamental kind of distortion. And as we'll see, jurisdictions split on that. With respect to the last case, Jewett versus Deutsch, the question is, what do you do with this so-called send a message argument? When the plaintiff, in effect, invites the jury to use their verdict as a way to send a message about, whether McDonald's did a good thing in selling coffee that was heated to 180 degrees, or other kinds of behavior where the jury disapproves of what the defendant has done, may the plaintiff's lawyer tell the jury that their verdict is in effect a message about the acceptability of some practice. Well, let's start with the per diem argument. It's not really a case in a classical presentation here. It's more a kind of description of this argument that Melvin Belli popularized. Melvin Belli was one of the early kind of flashy, big-time personal injury lawyers who kind of perfected the art of getting large awards. And he both bragged about it and evangelized about it to say, here's how to get big awards as I have done. And this was his technique. He said, don't ask the jury for a huge amount of money and just leave it like that. Put it in a more bite-sized format that makes it sound less intimidating. So let's suppose I had a case involving This is actually a real case that I represented the landlord who owned a building that was had a new roof put on it. The roof was put on in the form of this kind of, it was actually recoating of the roof, a kind of aluminized paint or coating of some kind, topping maybe. In any event, it was a flat roof with drains at various points or ways for the water to run off. But the workman for this roofing contractor had a truck with a big tank of this stuff in it, and then it was pumped up like a hose, sort of a reverse vacuum cleaner or like a spray device. He's got this wand, kind of like a, you know, self-service car wash or something, except it's got this aluminized paint coming out of the end of it. So he starts at one end of the roof and kind of, you know, goes back and forth spraying this stuff on. And as he's working his way, painting himself into a corner here, he backs into an electrical line. And you may, your perception may be that most electrical lines are insulated, but as we remember from Adams versus Bullock, well, that was trolley line, but it turns out just the regular electrical lines that are strung around town, the ones that come directly to your house, the so-called, you know, house drop, that after it's gone through the transformer, normal 220 voltage, those things are, you know, they have a rubber coating to them. They're insulated, but the lines going from across the poles down the neighborhood before they're in the transformer, they're typically just bare conductors. So anyway, there was one of these lines, and it happened to be strung across the rear corner of this building, just where this guy was backing into. So the line, you know, he hits it in the back of his neck, and it actually traveled through him, through the wand, through the hose, and actually started a fire in the truck two stories down. So he gets a pretty significant zap. In fact, the greatest thing is that his hands are sort of fused to this wand, that he's the metallic wand that he's holding, and his hands are really messed up. Okay, so this is the background for how do you present this to a jury. You first of all do a kind of day in the life of this guy. You show what his daily life is like dealing with these, you know, disfigured, you know, hands that are kind of all melted together here. The fingers are fused and missing and so forth. You know, zipping up his jacket, pouring his cereal, eating his cereal, driving a car, you know, walking into some place, people staring at his fingers and so on. What you do if you're Melvin Dalai is you say, now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, as you look at this, what do you think is fair compensation for my client here? What would be a reasonable amount of compensation? Now, you might go to a nice dinner and spend $50 for a nice dinner that would, you know, take maybe an hour or roughly that. What would you pay not to have hands like that? $50 too much? Is it worth $50 not to have, you know, hands fused into that? Just for an hour of this. I don't think that's too much. Maybe you think $50. Maybe it should be $40. Maybe it should be $35. $32. $28. I don't know. Somewhere in that. Is that too much? I don't think so. Well, let's look at that. 50 years times $28 an hour. Suddenly we're talking about a lot of money. But I didn't start with a lot of money making me look greedy. I start with saying, what's an hour's, even on a per diem, per day basis, one day, look at all the things he experienced in that one day. Is $350 for one day of that too much? Well, let's you know, plot this out over the next 50.7 years. Now, is there something wrong with that? Is that an unfair argument? Should plaintiffs be prohibited from making that argument? Remember that there is no prohibition against saying, ladies and gentlemen, jury, my client has been horribly injured by the defendant's negligence. I want you to give my client $700 gazillion. No, no restriction on that. Yeah. But why is the daily value any more illegitimate than the 50.7 years? I can ask for all 50.7 years at once and say that's $700 gazillion, but apparently I can't do the math for the jury to say what that works out to is $347 per day or whatever. Yeah. So then that would say it's better.
Yeah, I would argue that it is a good way for an individual, normal person to put it in perspective of their daily life.
Well then, Mr. Viviano. Well, I may have strayed too close to that. I can't really say how much would you have to be paid for me to, you know, have you hold a metal wand and, you know, turn the juice on. That's not the question. But I do get to ask the question: how much is fair compensation for this, you know, guy to be in this condition for 50.7 years? Is it absurd, or are we getting closer to the truth here? Yeah. Well, that's, again, the argument that the plaintiff makes as to why we should permit it. The defendant is worried that we have this sort of deceiving clarity, that it looks sort of scientific and it's really not. And worse yet, I think the defendant would say, actually, I've got my little diagram left over here, that what you're really dealing with is the mistake of thinking that the very first experience of something is typical of what it's like 10 years later or 20 years later. That as I imagine what it would be like to have to go through life with my fingers all misshapen, I tend to exaggerate it. It's sort of like, you know, that first a bite of the ice cream cone on a hot summer day. Yeah, that, you know, I get that ice cream cone and that first bite is just great. And even by the time I'm down to the bottom of the cone, I'm still happy to be eating this ice cream cone. I'm not going to throw it away. Most things in life have this kind of diminished effect. The first day I wake up realizing, you know, I've got these messed up hands, it's devastating, but over time I get used to it. And therefore, to the extent that what Melvin Belli is doing is taking this most intense experience and pretending that that's the way it's going to be for the rest of the plaintiff's life, it has a kind of deceptive scientific quality to it. You're actually better off to use the gross figure than you are to use the hourly or daily figure and extrapolate from it. Now, of course, the plaintiff turns around and says, you know, this is just an argument. You think it's misleading and deceptive? Well, the defendant, I'd be more than happy to have the defendant get up and say, oh, don't listen to the plaintiff's lawyer. It makes it sound so bad, but let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, he'll get used to it. Be my guest. I want to be there to watch when, you know, when the defendant does that. And the defendant says, you're right, of course, I couldn't say that. They just slap me across the courtroom if I tried to do that. But for that very reason, the plaintiff shouldn't be able to make an argument to which the logical comeback is off limits as a practical matter. And this, again, explains why some jurisdictions have said it's fair game. Everybody makes their best argument. And if you don't like it, make a different argument. And some jurisdictions have said, no, this is really giving the plaintiff an unfair advantage. It's allowing the jury to be manipulated in a way where the defendant can't point out the manipulation for fear of looking like a complete unsympathetic ogre. Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. I mean, that's an old concept here that you know, it is a good thing in many ways that I have to get up in the morning and go to work because, you know, I'm not entirely sure that left to my own devices, I would necessarily choose the things that would be best for me. On the other hand, if my employer tried to convince me that my employer was withholding some bonus because, well, let's face it, you know, this money wouldn't be good for you. You know, I would say, in fact, I don't think that's your choice to make. So, yeah, these are difficult phenomena. But again, as I say, the question of whether or not the plaintiffs, on the one hand, are taking advantage of their rhetorical capacity or of their ability to appeal to pathos as distinguished from reason, that's very much a concern. It's also a concern, I should say, in the Jewett versus Deutsch. We only have a few minutes here. Let me just cover this quickly. The law on this point is relatively uncontroversial. Namely, everybody agrees that in a compensatory award, you may not appeal to the jury to send a message to the defendant or to others similarly situated. Of course, that's perfectly appropriate if we are talking about punitive damages. So if it's Ford Motor Company getting punished for their reckless endangerment of the plaintiff, and punitive damages have been permitted, well, then that's exactly why we do award punitive damages, is to send a message. But if it's just a compensatory award, the amount of the award is not correlated with how much we approve or disapprove of the defendant's conduct. It is simply what is the amount of money the plaintiff needs to be made whole again after the law suffered through the defendant's negligence. But even though the law on this point is relatively clear, how you enforce it is another thing. If I'm the plaintiff's lawyer, I can still engineer the case so that it is portrayed as a contest between those who actually have some human feeling, namely the plaintiff's lawyer and that cause, versus the cold-hearted, number-crunching defendants for whom everything is relative. You may be familiar with the case of Pennzoil versus Texas, Joe Gemayel, this lawyer for Pennzoil, tried the case in front of a jury to decide whether or not Texaco had breached its contract to sell these oil fields or whatever they were, wells or properties to Pennzoil. And Texaco's defense was that this alleged agreement had never been reduced to writing. I mean, we're talking about this billion-dollar deal, and Texaco assumed that, sure, we had some preliminary negotiations about this. We even had some affirmative statements. I think we've got, you know, the basis of a deal here. We shook hands on it, but everybody knows that in business, the transfer doesn't become binding until you've actually signed the paperwork. And so what Joe Jamail did from day one in the trial was essentially to say, this is a case that involves the question about essentially what sort of values will drive our society. And at the end, you know, his closing argument in effect was, well, sure, these Texas fellers, I know these New York fellers over here, they'll tell you it ain't no deal until the lawyers get to it. But I say, here in Texas, when I hold out my hand and I say, I think we have a deal, we have a deal. What do you think? Have I said, send a message? Have I said, you know, throw out those, you know, people from New York? No, but I've essentially cast it in the form. Or similarly, if I'm suing Ford Motor Company and I say, you know, the Ford Motor Company, Johnny over here is just a statistic. He's just a line item in somebody's budget someplace. But ladies and gentlemen of the jury, today you have an opportunity to say that his life is worth something. Have I said send him, have I never used that phrase, send a message, but again, I've invited the jury to see this as, you know, it's a Mel Gibson movie here. Or you know, Master and Commander, Russell Crowe movie, you know? And to the extent that the jury is vulnerable, as we are all vulnerable to that, who wouldn't, or who would decline that invitation to vote for the good guys, not the number crunching bean counters but again, that's precisely what the defendant is complaining about, and again, what the defendant may be able to do is get the label out, but how can you forbid the plaintiff, clever plaintiff's lawyer, planning this from day one, the Joe Jamail, to cast the case in such a way that it evokes all of these feelings that what's at stake is this titanic battle of the forces of light versus the forces of dark? Yeah. Well, oftentimes they actually bifurcate the case. You remember in a civil action, they actually bifurcated the liability issues. That's unusual. But it's very common in punitive damage cases. I think this is what they did in the O.J. Simpson case. You first try the compensatory case, leave out all the evidence and the argument. You establish that there is compensatory liability. Then you have a supplemental phase, the second half of the bifurcated trial, in which you say, now let's talk about the punitive damages stuff, and you get the evidence and the argument, and you make a separate award. So that's one way to keep the two from commingling. But again, I'm saying in a straight compensatory award case, if I'm, as a plaintiff's lawyer, thinking about how I can get the jury's motor going, I have to be careful that I don't overplay my hand. I don't look like a complete phony and shyster. But at the same time, I have to be, you know, I want to be as effective an advocate as I can for my client. And there's a story of Ben Franklin that he used to go hear the evangelists, the missionaries. But before he went, he would take off all his jewelry and take all the money out of his pocket, and he, you know, stick a $5 bill in, and he'd go and he'd listen to people, and he knew that he would be moved by their stories to give them whatever he had. But he wanted, it was sort of like Ulysses tying himself to the mast. The real question is, when are you in your right mind? You know, Franklin at least thought he was in his right mind when he was putting all his money on his dresser table, and that he would be out of his mind in the hands of these, you know. But you could make the argument that maybe you're in your right mind when somebody finally gets to you. Anyway, have a happy Thanksgiving. We'll see you on Monday.